This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
I'm going to jump into a talk tonight about this world and about committing to a path of awakening in this world. Starting with just normalizing the reality of this world that we live in, with even just a glance at history and the present social, political reality of this world. It's so clear to see how much ignorance has influenced mankind, how how much violence and hatred and oppression this world, with its history of wars and racism, sexism, homophobia, with example after example of greed and delusions about happiness coming from accumulating things and pleasure. The Buddha talked about this realm that we're in, the earth, human realm, as samsara, as the cycle of perpetually wandering from existence to existence, moment to moment, and that this wandering that we're all in at the moment is fueled by greed and hatred and delusion. And that it's in every single living being. And sometimes it manifests as the simple craving for comfort and intolerance for discomfort. And that craving for comfort sometimes gets magnified into gross greed and lust and total ignorance of who we harm in order to get what we want. Or that aversion to discomfort, that biological survival instinct of fight or flight, of have to get away from the pain of the discomfort that we all have. Maybe you experienced some of it in meditation just now. I don't feel comfortable. I gotta get the fuck out of here. Or I need to itch, or I need to move, or I better fidget. I gotta avoid this pain, this unpleasantness. Nobody is born with a very good ability to tolerate pain and or meet it with the wise response of compassion. Especially our own. There are some people who seem to be pretty good at caring about other people's pain, being compassionate, being caring. A Sangha member recently sent me an article about studying, I think it was apes or chimpanzees, or that were showing behavior of kind of empathy and compassion for each other. That even in the animal kingdom, that we see examples of that. And certainly in the human realm, we see that, where some of us were pretty good at caring about others. But who, when they stub their toe, just says, "Oh, poor toe. I have mercy and compassion for you"? Nobody. It's against our survival instinct to learn to be naturally compassionate towards our own pain. We fucking hate it. We want to get rid of it. We want to escape it. We want to avoid it. There's this instinct within us that says pain will equal death. And we got to get rid of it. And that instinct gets magnified into every form of violence, every form of oppression, every war is based either on greed or hatred, and all fueled by ignorance about the solution to pain, about the ability to forgive, about the ability to have compassion. Not only for others, but also for ourselves, for our own pain. The Buddha, through his own efforts, and this is a very important line, through his own efforts, no grace, no blessing, no magic, through his own training of his mind, investigating the human condition, being mindful and closely attentive to what's happening in this world, came to the realization that because everything is impermanent and half of it is pleasant and we cling to pleasure and half of it is unpleasant and we push unpleasantness away, and it's probably not half because then there's that whole area of neutral. Can't really give it a percentage. We can't really say a third of it is pleasant, a third is neutral, and a third is unpleasant. But it's this mixture, existence is this mixture of pleasure and pain and neutrality. Born into a body that is not in harmony with the impermanent pleasure, pain, and neutrality that creates stress and fear and anxiety and depression and anger and hatred and lust and oppression about the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral nature of existence. He came to the realization that compassion was the only wise relationship to pain. Through his own effort, through his own experience, and not realization, but experience. When I meet pain with compassion, I end suffering. When we meet pain with compassion, we end the suffering. We don't end pain. And so then there's a different definition of pain and suffering that is necessary for us to know. Pain's not the problem. Hatred is the problem. Aversion to pain is the problem. It is a dysfunctional relationship to pain. But it's the norm, right? We live in this dysfunctional body, world, society, samsara. And dysfunctional, as in the function of hating pain is to try to get rid of it. But it doesn't work, right? It's the function is broken. Hatred does not work for anything except for making ourselves and others miserable. Except for creating more pain, more oppression, more ignorance, adding to the problem in this world. It is an unwise, undysfunctional relationship. But it's the norm, right? You look at this world and you see how do people relate to pain? They hate it. How do I relate to pain? I hate it. The Buddha's other realization with the impermanent, all of this other experience that was pleasurable, and saw that survival instinct of I love pleasure, I want to hold on to it forever. Cling to it. It will make me happy. It will make me survive. It will. But the problem is, it's impermanent. It passes as soon as we cling to pleasant thoughts, feelings, emotions, sensations, people, places, experiences. Then we create suffering on that. That's greed. That's clinging. That's attachment to the impermanent phenomena that's being pulled beyond our grasp. And the only wise relationship to pleasure becomes non-attached appreciation. Non-clinging, while enjoying it, right? Not avoiding pleasure, like, oh, that's the problem. Pleasure's great, enjoy it. But as soon as we dig our grubby little nails into it, we ruin it. We create stress, we create fear, we create this whole extra level of dissatisfaction that is not necessary. You get it, right? That's the same talk I give every week for the last 10 years. And as a side note, for those of you who are looking for the higher teaching, there is none. There's no higher teaching than that. The Buddha kept the Dharma simple, practical, and applicable. At one point, he said, he used this analogy of a handful of leaves. A couple different times, he used this sort of practical analogy of a handful. He said, you know, because people would ask him, like, you're just giving us the same talk over and over. People said it to me. And he would say, well, and maybe somebody asked him something like, well, don't you know more than just the Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path? You've heard that Dharma talk for 30 years now. He would say, well, I know more, but I only teach. He said, what's more, all of the leaves in the forest or this handful of leaves right here in my hand? They said, well, obviously in the forest there's more leaves than what's in your hand. He said, but I only teach this handful because that's all you need. In order to understand the full, everything that can be understood, all of the leaves in the forest, you just need this handful. You just need mindfulness and concentration and right understanding and right speech and right view and right livelihood, right action. That's all you need. And you will get it. You will get free. You will know for yourself. Compassion, non-attachment, ethical behavior. Now, I want to shift a little bit now that we have normalized what's going on here to this where we started with, like, wise beings. Wise beings are incredibly rare in this world. There was another time, just upon his awakening, when the Buddha was a little bit hesitant to teach, and he said, you know, people are just this humanity, this world, so fucking asleep. That was a quote, so fucking asleep. He said, it's like their eyes are caked with mud. And at some point he realized, oh no, there are some beings in this world who just have some dust in their eyes. Some are completely, and we know them, right? And some people in this world, they're just completely asleep, stuck. Just, they believe in greed and hatred and delusion. They believe in it. They pray to it. And there are those who are starting to wake up, and he said, I will teach for those. He said, I believe that there will be a handful in each generation who will hear the Dharma, these teachings, this truth, and who will apply it and purify their own heart and mind. But he said he thought only a handful in each generation. He didn't really have, in his mind, he didn't really have hope for, like, the whole world, to transform. He thought, actually, this world is on fire. He talked about everything is burning with greed and hatred and delusion. But that there are those in each generation who will wake up, who will do the hard, counterintuitive, against the stream practice of developing compassion, of developing the skill of non-clinging through mindfulness, through ethical behavior. Just a handful. So tonight, as we began, for those of you who weren't here, we named some of the people in this world that we think are on that list of the handful. And some people had a hard time, right? And they kind of had to reach. Do I know anybody that's not completely asleep? Can I even think of very many saints and sages and real, you know, I like to use like spiritual revolutionaries? Or I've come to think of this handful as 1%. Maybe a handful of leaves, a handful of people is like the 1% of this world. And hey, with almost 7 billion people, 1% being almost 70 million people, not bad. You think there's 70 million people who are walking a path of compassion? A path of non-clinging? A path of being awake. Now, I would say that there's a couple of things that are necessary in order for this list, in order to be on the kind of one percenter list, that are kind of non-negotiable. And number one is a commitment to nonviolence. I don't think that anybody can be considered a one percenter, can be considered a spiritual revolutionary who has in their ideology any rationalization for violence. Now, I'm not saying that some of the one percenters, some of the spiritual revolutionaries may at times be imperfect and speak violently or maybe even act violently, but they don't think it's okay. They don't rationalize it. They don't have as part of their ideology. There can be imperfection is what I'm saying. There can be imperfection in action. But that spiritual revolutionaries, one percenters, understand the importance of nonviolence and have it up front as one of the core guiding principles of their life. There's probably a longer list. The other thing that I want to say, and I think this is going to be much more controversial, so kind of take this maybe lightly if you don't like it. I would propose that another quality of an awakened being, of a one percenter, of a spiritual revolutionary, is that they are, I want to say always, but I'm going to say almost always, atheists. That with the awakening comes an understanding that we are fully and completely responsible. And that there isn't some mystical, magical anything to blame or praise, but one's own actions and one's own responses. This was what the Buddha awakened to. He understood that there was no theistic powers in control. And he understood that human beings had everything that they needed for awakening within themselves. That having been said, this realm of one percenters, of spiritual revolutionaries, I certainly don't think are all going to be Buddhists. I think that there are Christian and Muslim and Jewish and Native American and African shamans and, you know, across the board in this handful that are committed to nonviolence, and who perhaps, even if they continue the mask and uniform of a theistic religion, in their heart of hearts, they understand that this isn't a realm where we're being controlled by some external godhead creature, creator. Even if they continue to use that language. I made a list. Of one percenters. Nonviolent atheists. Committed to their own awakening and to a compassionate, engaged relationship to the world. And almost always what comes is a commitment to creating positive change in this world. Almost never is it this kind of escapism, going to live in a cave for the rest of my life. The Buddha spent 7 years in his own deep practice for awakening and the rest of his life teaching, giving it away, political, social, engaged, activist, spiritual revolutionary. Trying to find every being that he could that had a little dust in their eyes so he could help guide them in wiping it away and awakening and joining the revolution. So the Buddha, one percenter. Number two, Jesus Christ. Now you might say, wait a minute, atheist? Okay, so maybe I'm reaching. I have no idea. I'm not that familiar with actually what he said, but I'll take one, I'll cherry pick for my convenience, one quote that I'm aware of.
Alan Watts.
Okay, Alan, we like him. We could put him on the list, maybe. The kingdom of heaven is within. Whether Jesus said that or not, I don't know, but if he did, I think he's an atheist. I think that he knew that what we were looking for was inside of us. And I know that, or we think also, that he was somebody who was committed to nonviolence and creating a positive change and critiquing the corrupt religious structures of his time, just like the Buddha was doing 500 years before him. And then some New Age people like to say, well, you know, Jesus went to India and he learned a lot of that shit from the Buddhists. So, most Christians would not say that that's quite what we're talking about, but anyways, that's what I'm saying tonight. An Islamic example of one percenters. Now, no offense to my Muslim friends, and some of my closest friends are Muslims, but personally, from what I know about Muhammad, may peace be upon him, we couldn't put him on the one percenter list because, as far as I know, he was totally okay with violence. He thought it was appropriate in certain situations. And so for me, that excludes you from being a one percenter or a spiritual revolutionary from this perspective. But some of the Islamic atheist revolutionaries committed to nonviolence that I would put on the list are Rumi and Hafiz. These Muslim Sufi mystics who continue to speak in a theistic language, but if you read their words, it's so clear that they're not talking about a creator that is controlling the universe. that they're talking about the beloved and the sacred that is within each one of us and within all things. Even though they continue to pray five times a day and be good Muslims, I propose they were atheist revolutionaries, speaking in the context of their time. Mother Teresa, is she Catholic? Catholic example of a one percenter. I think a few years ago when she died, they had her journals and they were talking about, even in her journals, she was saying, I really doubt the existence of God. And I heard a quote from her one time. She was interviewed and somebody said, the interviewer said, so Mother Teresa, tell me about prayer. When you pray, what do you say to God? And she said, when I pray, I don't say anything to God, I just listen. And the interviewer, a little confused, said, well, what does God say to you while you're listening? And she said, God doesn't say anything, God just listens. So she makes the list. Thomas Merton, somebody who continued to live within this Christian, theistic, monastic life, studied Buddhism. I believe from what I've studied of him that he understood that it wasn't this external creator business that they would have us think, but that it was actually within each one of us, and that awakening was our practice and not grace and not blessing. I'm not sure, but put him on the list. Krishnamurti, who I like very much for his commitment to nonviolence, his commitment to service, and his commitment to speaking the truth and to speaking in a way that defied religious and spiritual expectations. Just wasn't willing to play the religious game, but to be in integrity with the truth. His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama, Tenzin Gyatso. Many different reasons why, you know, clearly he, you know, kind of fits the atheist commitment to nonviolence. One of the inspiring recent things, you know, a couple years ago when he said, you know, if science proves Buddhism wrong, we need to change Buddhism to come into harmony with proven, factual, atheist, scientific understanding. Who else made the list? I added a couple while you were saying yours. Thoreau, Kerouac, Pema Chodron, Jack Kornfield, Stephen and Martine Batchelor, Aung San Suu Kyi, Gloria Steinem, Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King. Who else?
Emerson.
Thich Nhat Hanh.
Desmond
Tutu. Desmond.
Nelson.
Your mama? Very important point, right? That yes, we can make a little list, and but the one percenters, the spiritual revolutionaries, can be anyone. Can be the little old lady, the young person, can be anyone who, in their heart, is guided by nonviolence. Who in their heart is taking full responsibility for all of their actions. Who in their heart is practicing kindness, is practicing generosity, is practicing, right, has that intention. I think that very, very few people in this world even have those intentions. I think very few even of the Buddhists who are studying this path, really are guided in that way by non-greed and non-hatred and non-delusion. You know, we could get a little bit more specific to practicing mindfulness, practicing generosity, practicing concentrating the mind. It's said that only something like 10% of Buddhists meditate. It's very clear, according to the original teachings, that it's impossible to really change our relationship to pleasure and pain, to greed and hatred, without meditation. You can't think your way to it. You can't believe your way to it. Faith is not enough. It says somewhere, faith without works is dead. Biblical, I guess? The biblical book? It's the work that matters, not what we believe. And to truly be this kind of one percenter, that handful, those with little dust, it's the people in this world that are doing the practice to purify their heart, to change their relationship to pleasure and pain, to break free from the ignorant conditioning around sex and gender and status and politics and... doing the work. And so some of them are famous and have made huge political, spiritual contributions to our world, and some are completely unknown, living in Iowa, living in Africa, living in Silver Lake. But it feels... It's tricky talking about 1% without turning it into spiritual pride or ego or separatism or us against them. I don't feel us against them at all, but I feel like it's actually realistic when we look at this world, when we look at how many people are actually doing the work, that it's a very small percentage of people who begin and continue a path, as my teacher Jack Kornfield would say, a path with heart. And whether they're Muslims or Sufis or Christians or Buddhists or atheists, scientists, that outer trapping doesn't matter so much. It's the path with heart that matters.
So when we meditate and destroy, what is it that we get to pray?
Greed, hatred, and delusion. Attachment, aversion, belief in a permanent self, thus ignorance. That is the destruction. The destruction of the taints. The destruction of ignorance. The destruction of attachment. The destruction of greed. Of a fear-based existence.
And it seems like the intent of that kind of life would not be pain or things. So it wouldn't matter whether those people were acknowledged or not.
Yeah. Yes. Although, if we look at the Buddha, we also understand that there's something important about if you have an important message, if you have an important teaching, and you're in integrity of gaining the support and popularity so that it becomes more and more available. I was recently talking to somebody about money and dharma and fame and all of this stuff, and they're saying, oh, well, my teacher, you know, he lives very simply, and, you know, he just lives on the donations. And I said, yeah, but what if he had more so that his teachings could spread further and he had centers in every city around the country? What good would that do? He's a great teacher. I want his teachings to be available everywhere, not just in his sort of little, I do what I can do because I want to stay humble and don't want too much attention. What if his teachings were everywhere so they could be accessed? Because he's a wonderful teacher. I want everyone in Arkansas to learn his meditation method. But he would never go there because he wouldn't get any donations. And he doesn't want to be too famous. Right? So I think there's a piece of that.
No, it's not about wanting to be famous. If it comes, it comes.
So yes, if it comes. It's not the goal. It's not the goal. But you see someone like the Dalai Lama, who certainly wasn't his goal, but he's done so much good by becoming the modern spiritual rock star that he is. He's inspired so many people by being the most famous Buddhist in the world. Certainly wasn't his intention, but it's useful to have that kind of popularity when your message is a wholesome one.
I feel like in our modern culture, the kind of wave of 60s love, like a lot of these ideas became more widespread than probably any other time in history through modern communication, plus this awareness of this, and this sort of wave rose up, and then, you know, I don't know if it's punk rock or, you know, Reagan or whatever, it just kind of backed off and went away, and, you know, I feel sort of somewhere I was in that generation that had this awareness and could have maybe taken it to the next level, didn't.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sort of fascinated by that phenomenon and based on the fame of these people or how much good they can do. I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that.
I wonder at like of you know, when Ram Dass was at his height of popularity and 3,000 people were coming out, and there was the sit-ins, and all of, you know, 10,000 people were coming out, and maybe 1% of those people are still practicing. Some of them are still practicing. But what happens is that it gets real. You get all inspired, right? It's happened to many of us. You read the book, you get inspired, you hear the lecture, you get inspired. And after a while, it's like, he's giving the same fucking talk again. I really have to actually do this? And so very few people actually follow through. Many people start a path. Very few people follow through on a path. And so, and sometimes in history, it seems like in the 60s, or you know, probably we could go back, that there's these waves where there's these great teachers and there's consciousness that arises. But even in that, only few. Even in the time of the Buddha, fully enlightened being there, the masses rejected his teaching. He was only popular to a few, to thousands within the millions and millions of people that heard his teachings. Heard about his teachings. So it's just, again, it's like it's not for everyone. Because it's against looking for an easier, softer way, and every other religion will give you a pretty easy out. Oh no, you don't have to do all the work. Just say this prayer. Bliss in the afterlife, right? Almost every other says, like, actually, not only do you not have to, you can't. It's not even possible for you to train your mind. That's the devil speaking.
Even in Buddhism, there's that, though.
Even in Buddhism, there's that. That's why a lot of Buddhists don't even meditate. The best I can hope for is if I give to the monks, I'll get a good rebirth. I'm going to share something from Against the Stream. Maybe we'll end with this. Our human society is founded on confusion, ignorance, and lies. The legacy of violence and greed that our ancestors have left in their wake is the foundation on which we find ourselves standing today. When we commit to the spiritual revolution, we commit to uncovering and developing the truth that has been obscured by the confusion of greed, hatred, and ignorance. Through meditation, wise actions, and service, we will come to understand the importance of generosity, kindness, forgiveness, and compassion. We will align our life with the truth of total personal responsibility. Serving the truth comes down simply to living life from a place of positive intentions. This may be counterintuitive, in fact. It may be the most radical stance one can take. It means rigorous honesty to self and others. It means doing the right thing even when everything and everyone in society is telling you to ignore, to suppress, or abandon the path of nonviolence, understanding, and care. The truth is that violence is never the answer. There is no winner in violent conflict, only harm caused to both sides. The spiritual revolutionary, the one percenter, practices nonviolence. The truth is that selfishness, greed, never lead to happiness or contentment. Greed feeds discontent. The spiritual revolutionary practices generosity and service in the face of self-centeredness. The truth is that ignoring or denying the oppression and confusion in the world is part of the problem. If we're not part of the solution, we are the problem. The spiritual revolutionary is engaged with the world and responds to oppression with open eyes and a willingness to protect others and alleviate oppression. At times, this response comes in the form of education. At other times, in the forms of hands-on, nonviolent action. The truth is that we are all grieving the losses of the past. Due to impermanence, everything is constantly dying. There is sorrow for the loss of all things. The spiritual revolutionary practices openness to the sorrow of existence, meeting change with understanding and pain with compassion. The truth is that pleasure is addictive. We are all addicted to it. We crave for life to be always pleasant and never painful. The spiritual revolutionary practices non-attachment, breaking the addiction to the mind and enjoying the pleasure of life as it comes and goes. The truth is that our suffering is optional. In life, pain and pleasure are given, but we create suffering for ourselves through our own clinging to pleasure and our aversion to pain. The spiritual revolutionary practices radical acceptance, enjoying pleasure when it is present, accepting and caring about pain when it is present. The truth is that much of the difficulty and confusion in life is impersonal. The human mind and body are not naturally in harmony with impermanence. This disharmony is not personal. It is just the developed survival mechanism of our species. The one percenter trains herself to understand the impersonal reactive tendencies of the mind and body. The truth is that freedom is possible in each moment and in this very life. We have the ability to let go, to let be, and to respond with care and understanding to what is happening in each moment. So, serve the truth. And then I go on to say, but beware of teachers. Some of my thoughts. I add each one of you to this list of one percenters. If you care to commit your life's energy to understanding the importance of nonviolence in speech, in action, and if you care to understand the truth of total personal atheist responsibility for all of your actions and for your own salvation. But don't believe me. Find out for yourself if what I have said or any of these teachings or Buddhist ideas don't lead you to less suffering and more well-being, then reject them and find for yourself the path with heart that leads you to the freedom that you seek.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.